Hi there, I'm Natasha Jansons and welcome to Sense in the City, the podcast where we discuss a topic even more taboo than sex. I am talking, of course, about money. This week we are shining the light on a topic that may be distressing to some listeners, and that's domestic violence. My guest this week is Kylie Travers, who has openly shared her story of going from being a homeless mother on Centrelink to an international award-winning CEO, as well as sharing the misconceptions that cause many women not to recognise that they are in an abusive relationship and therefore should be taking action. For more information from Kylie, please check out her website, kylietravers.com.au. Please be advised that the following content may be distressing to some listeners. Welcome to the program, Kylie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just dive in. Would you mind to share with us your story?
Sure. So I think the things I'm most commonly known for and what I talk about the most is the fact that I've gone from being a homeless single mother to multi-award-winning CEO. And what sort of happened for me was in 2012, my marriage fell apart because it was an abusive one. And I decided at that point that I'd had enough. I had two young daughters and I took them and left. After he got particularly violent one night and the police came and it was all quite messy. Within a week of leaving, I actually got robbed of everything, including my underwear. And then following that, I was raped in the home we'd moved into by somebody that I trusted. And very few people actually knew where we lived. And then we ended up homeless for a while. So went from, you know, decent house, living in the suburbs, married, all that sort of thing, to homeless with two daughters who had learning issues that I had to help. And it was all rather intense and traumatic, and he was still stalking us at the time. And so from there I managed to move my daughters and I back to Canberra where my family were, and rebuilt and launched a company, ended up winning a bunch of awards, and now I live in Melbourne in a house I love with a partner that I love, and my daughters have improved drastically, and very, very different life to what I had a couple of years ago.
How long ago did all that happen?
Almost 5 years ago it sort of started. So early 2012 was when I separated, and then it was towards the end of that year that things got really bad, because originally we separated and we were under one roof because he was working nights, so I stayed out during the day and I simply couldn't afford to go anywhere else. And at that time, even though I was in it and I knew how bad it was, I didn't actually know how bad it was. Like, I knew it wasn't good, but it wasn't until I actually got out completely that I realised how bad it was. And so it was the end of 2012 was when we went to a new place and got robbed and everything that like that happened. And then, yeah, it was 2013 that we were homeless. So that's, yeah, nearly 4 years ago now. And it was about mid-2013 that I moved back to Canberra and started to rebuild. So it's not that long ago.
No, and you've done an amazing amount of things in such a short amount of time in amongst all those obstacles and challenges that you had to go through. Can we go through your story, if you don't mind, sort of circling back to the beginning of the relationship and how it evolved and got to the point of you finally deciding to leave?
Yeah, sure. So I was married at 19. I was raised Mormon, and so did the whole Mormon thing, got married young, and, you know, went on to have kids fairly young. It actually took me a year and a half to fall pregnant. But initially when we were dating, he seemed really nice. Everybody thought he was really good. We met through our church. I'm no longer a member of that church, but that's how we met. And I was strongly encouraged to marry him because I wouldn't find anybody better. I had a lot of self-esteem issues at the time. And I guess I was considered a little bit of a problematic teenager as far as the church was concerned, where, I don't know, I don't think I was that bad, but I had self-esteem issues, and I think he sort of preyed on that. And my self-esteem became a little bit dependent on him. And then we got married, and it was from the wedding night that it was really clear that I didn't have control in this relationship at all. Not that I wanted control, but it wasn't an equal relationship. And things sort of went downhill from there. He controlled what I wore. I was no longer allowed to wear pink because he thought I looked too pretty in it and didn't want other men looking at me. I wasn't allowed to wear lingerie because, again, he didn't want other men looking, and it's like, that's your underwear. Nobody else has seen that but my husband. But, yeah, I wasn't allowed to do those sorts of things. I wasn't allowed to talk to other men. He'd get really, really jealous if I spoke to other men. And so it was bit by bit that he started to take away my control, and we were living in Sydney away from my family, so I was sort of cut off from my support network. And yeah, just over time, he took away all the self-esteem and I lost myself really in that relationship. And then we had our daughters. I've got two daughters to him, and I sort of just felt stuck most of the time. And funnily enough, it was my daughters that prompted me to change things, because they were at one and two. No, not even, no. They were, sorry, two and almost two and a baby. And I set a goal to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30, because I realized that the life that I had wouldn't improve unless I chose to do something about it. And so I started writing about ways to make and save money and that sort of thing. And then within a year, I got offered a book contract with Wiley. And so that sort of gave me a little bit of confidence. And then I was nominated for Best International Personal Finance Blog. And it was just like, oh my gosh, I'm worth something. And so I went to that conference, and that was my first international speaking gig as well, because I was asked to speak at it too. So that was amazing. And I met some amazing people there, and I came back from that feeling like I was actually worth something. And we'd been married for six, 7 years by that point. And then, so that was 2011. And then yeah, in 2012, some issues that had come up in our relationship quite a few times, just I couldn't handle it anymore. And so that was it. I was done. And yeah, said we're separating. But I don't think it really became real to him until later that year, when I went to the same conference again, FinCon, and spoke at it again. And I won the award that year and all those sorts of things. So I came back on a massive high and really confident. And that's when he's just gone, holy crap. And so, yeah, things got quite severe there. But it was really a gradual process of basically making me dependent on him, which is really common within situations like this. And had I not started blogging, I think I'd probably still be in that relationship.
Were you allowed to sort of go out and see your friends? Did he control that aspect of your life in an attempt to sort of cut you off further?
A little bit. We lived in Sydney, and we got married fairly quickly after I moved there. So I sort of moved there and met him within a few months. And then within 2 months of dating, we were married, and 4 months, I'm sorry, 2 months of dating, we were engaged, and 4 months later we were married. So it was like 6 months. So I didn't have a huge amount of people that I knew there that weren't his friends, if that makes sense. I'd moved up with my best friend, but she moved to Queensland. So everybody I knew was connected with him, and I didn't really, I guess, have my own space, because even when I went out with him, he knew everything that was going on anyways. And he did definitely try to keep a distance between myself and my family. He particularly didn't like me talking too much or spending too much time with my sisters, because we're extremely close. And I think he saw that as a threat. And my family were the ones that supported me heavily when I left the relationship. But yeah, I think because we were on his turf at the time, he already had that control. He didn't have to try and gain it too much.
Was he physically violent sort of from the beginning, or did that happen towards the end when he realised you were wanting to leave him?
It was a bit of a mix. So in the beginning, it was things like he'd pin me down, or he would hold my wrists together, or push me into the wall and things like that. I didn't get the punch to the face type thing. He would pretend to king hit me, like come within an inch of my face and things like that. So I'd flinch. Like there's one particular time, I didn't realize my daughter remembered this, and she would have only been about 2 or 3 years old. And we pulled up in the driveway, and I can't remember what happened exactly, but he went to king hit me, and I moved my head and I actually hit my head on the window because I was trying to get away from his punch. And my daughter saw my head. She was sitting directly behind me, just saw my head hit the window, and she like saw dad's fist come out, obviously. And then my head hit the window, and she was hysterical because she thought he had hit me in the head, but he'd just missed. And so that's the sort of thing that I went through. And she actually brought this up just last year, and she's 9 now. And I had no idea that she remembered seeing that and that sort of thing. So a lot of mine wasn't actually as physical as a lot of other abusive relationships, which is where I think I struggled a little bit to see it as an abusive relationship for so long, because I wasn't actually being hit. I didn't have bruises. My skin, like I wasn't bleeding or anything, because I wasn't cut like that until, yeah, after we separated is actually when it got significantly worse, and he pulled a knife on me and things like that, which is statistically extremely common. It's the most dangerous time is when women or men, if they're leaving an abusive relationship, when you're leaving is the most dangerous time, and it's when most of the actual murders happen is in the separation period. Yeah, so it can be quite difficult and quite scary. But yeah, it was when he realised that he was losing control that he got significantly more violent. But he, throughout the relationship though, he exerted control in other ways, like with finances and things like that, which is another common way for them to gain control that people sort of don't realise is happening, where we had joint accounts always. I didn't have my own account. It wasn't until I started, ING had a bonus sign-up thing, I think it was, and I got $75 if I signed up for my own account. So he let me do that because that was $75 that we were going to get. And then I think he just forgot about it. And so I kept that kind of private. But another time when I tried to set up a separate account and I was sort of planning on leaving, I went down to the bank, got it set up, explained the situation and requested that statements not be sent to the house and all this sort of stuff. And they agreed to that and it was all set up. And then one day they called me and he was in front of me. And so I was forced to go down and close the account because, you know, like he didn't want me having money outside of him. And so it was just by fluke that I got that ING one and then was able to start saving money from like online surveys and little bits and pieces here and there. And he didn't realize I was sort of making some money from blogging at that point. Well, as much as I was, I let him know some of the stuff. And obviously when I got the book contract, I had to tell him about the money they pay you before you do the book. But yeah, like I had to tell him all of that. And he was also giving like money to his family at different times and stuff like that. So I never had any money that I could do much with or anything like that because it was all together. And that's, yeah, another thing that happens in these sort of relationships. It's generally a combination of financial, physical, and then mental and emotional abuse. But it usually starts with like finances and emotion. So you don't really realize you're in it until you're in too deep, and then it turns physical.
And thank you for raising those points, because I've heard so many stories of women being in those situations, but because we use the term domestic violence rather than another phrase, I don't know what would be more adequate, a lot of women associate that as only being it being physical. And they think to themselves, well, I'm not getting punched and this isn't happening and that's not happening, or it's not quite so bad. And they talk themselves out of it or talk it down to sort of say, no, this isn't, I'm over exaggerating. And I'm sure that what the abuser is doing, as far as what you said around stripping away your self-confidence and making you doubt yourself, is just adding to that further, because they will flat out deny to your face, no, I never said that, you're imagining that, you know, you, yeah, whatever it is, just to make yourself doubt yourself even further. And you just sort of sit there and you go, no, I must be making it up, I'm exaggerating it, no, it's not, you know, it wasn't that. And from what I've heard, that is so often what prevents them from taking any action, because they're not able to recognize it for what it is and as bad as it is as well. And as you said, you didn't really realize how bad it was until you were out of it and looked back on it. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So even now, sometimes I've gone to say something or do something and there's been realizations, and I just sort of look at my partner and I'm like, how did I not know this when I was in it? And he's like, well, if that's all you've known, though, that's, you have nothing else to base it on. And, you know, I was raised in a strict religion and I was originally from Hobart, so southern Tassie, and Tassie was a little bit more like a 1950s upbringing is what I think I had, and most people sort of say. And so you look at it and we're not actually that far out from the 50s and 60s and 70s and that, where it was normal for the men to have total control in the relationship with the finances and all that sort of stuff. And so I think in many ways it's quite confusing for Generation X and below to find that line, because their parents were of a generation where it's okay and it's normal for the husband to have control of the finances, but it's not healthy. And so many of them that are in those sorts of relationships, you often turn to your mum first or something. And when you don't have a generation that realizes how wrong that is and what a disadvantage it is for you to be in a relationship where somebody else has total financial control, or, you know, is putting you down constantly, it's really difficult to find that sense of this is actually wrong, when the people in your family are going, no, you're fine, like it doesn't really matter. No, in my relationship when I grew up or whatever, my dad had control or whatever. And so it's really difficult to find that balance, because that's what it was in my family. My dad worked and my mum was a stay-at-home mum, but they had a wonderful marriage. She passed away in the year 2000, but they had a great marriage and that was what worked for them and that was what they wanted. Like my mum, all she wanted was to be a stay-at-home mum, and even when she was dying she felt fulfilled because she'd done what she'd wanted to do. So it was very different, and that made it kind of confusing for me, though, because I wanted what they had, but then I didn't have the respect and the love in the relationship, just sort of had all the, you know, lack of financial control and those sorts of things in it. And so I think for many it's hard to find that line. And then we don't talk about finances much as a society. We sort of keep that kind of private. And often what happens in many abusive relationships that I've spoken to people in it, or at events that I've spoken at, and just looking at the stats and that sort of thing, it's things like debt will be put into the victim's name. I hate using the word victim, but yeah, the person who's being abused, the debt will be put into their name. All the electrical bills and everything will be put into their name. And so even if they leave, they're lumped with all this stuff. And in the first place, how are they supposed to get the money to leave? And it's just there's all these problems. And when you're in it, you don't realise that you're in it. And so there's problem after problem. It often takes somebody outside of the relationship or outside the person that's being abused to see what's going on and sort of give them a little bit of advice, and generally not hit them with everything right up going, hey, this is how bad your relationship is, but just drip feed to begin with and just see where they're at first to begin with, and then offer them a way out, because it's really difficult when you're in it to create that plan for yourself, to realise how wrong it is and create that plan and get out.
How do you approach someone if the person is in denial about what is taking place? How can you get through to them without risking isolating them even further?
Yeah, this is the really hard part, because sometimes it's denial, sometimes they just have no clue, and then even when they find out, it's like they then go into denial. So there's often that sort of stage to it. Got to be really gentle about how you discuss it. Don't be judgmental. Too many people sort of come in and are really judgmental about it, which makes the person who's being abused just go into their shell and not want to tell anybody anything. So it's about approaching it in a loving manner, speaking really calmly with anything that you're discussing, never making them feel at fault or demanding that they leave right now or anything like that. Or it's like, you know, you have to leave this relationship, blah, blah, blah. At the beginning, that sort of thing can be a bit too confronting. If they've come to you and said, you know, I need help, I need to do something, then you can go a bit harder. But if you're sort of broaching the subject with them, then, yeah, take it sort of gently. See how they respond, like watch their body language and that sort of thing. And just make it really clear that you'll be there to support them, and that, you know, anything said in this conversation is just between the two of you. And you can actually do some research before you have that conversation. So if you know what help is available for people who are going through this, what financial resources there are, what shelters there are, how to go about all of it, then that can help a lot. Because if they are then ready within the conversation to go, okay, yeah, actually I do need to leave, what do I do or whatever, you're prepped with information to help them, if that makes sense. Because if they sort of realize that they're in an abusive relationship, it can be a little bit overwhelming to then work out what it is that they want to do. Plus, their devices are usually being tracked. So if they jump on and start searching this sort of thing, it tips off their abuser and things can get nasty really quickly. So if you sort of do that research and then can provide them with the information and do it all really calm, I think the most important thing is to stay really calm about it and really supportive, then all of that can help.
And can you give us some idea of what sort of support services are available?
Yeah, so there's heaps, actually. It can be hard at the beginning to access it, and funding has been cut to a fair few of them. But Centrelink actually do provide some advances and specific payments and that sort of thing to help people leave abusive relationships. I think the most important thing is to report and record everything. So if the person that's in the relationship isn't actually at a stage to or doesn't feel comfortable reporting it to the police, at least keeping like a diary, or if you as a witness see anything, you reporting it or you recording it and that sort of thing, gathering all that sort of evidence. Because when you go to the police, there is a domestic violence officer. The hearings for AVOs and DVOs are heard generally on one particular day in the court, and there's a victim's room for the people that are applying for the DVO so that they don't have to sit out there with their abusers and these sorts of things. So there are systems in place to protect you, but it's important that you follow the process. And then generally the police will connect you to a bunch of other services as well. There's things like women health centres. Most women health centres have accesses to like a community lawyer for you, or can refer you to community legal centres, which is huge, because I found them to actually be better than legal aid. Legal aid weren't that beneficial in my circumstance, but legal aid is another option if you can't afford to go to another lawyer or like pay full price for a lawyer and that sort of thing. So yeah, there's Centrelink, there's legal aid, there's loads of charities. Different charities offer different things, but it can be things like they can help you with your bond or paying for electrical bills or providing clothing, food vouchers, those sorts of things. There's a lot of places you can get free food and that sort of thing. And actually in the planning stage, if you're accessing any of those services and you're given like cash for grocery money, it means you can get the groceries from there and sort of hide the cash from your partner for a while so that you can build up a little bit of a savings fund to leave when you need to leave. There are some banks now that are actually providing some services and loans and these sorts of things to people leaving abusive relationships. There's interest-free loans as well if you need things like white goods and that sort of stuff. I think it's called NILS, like the no-interest loan scheme. Yeah, so there is a lot of that, but then there's also the shelters and the women's refuges and those sorts of things. The Women's Health Centre that I mentioned before as well, the one that I had access to in Penrith actually had like a masseuse and a naturopath that you could access for a discounted rate, and they had classes that you could join in. They did fitness and free counselling and all those sorts of things. So there are a lot of services out there. Plus, if you're needing counselling, you can actually go to your GP and go on a mental health plan, and then you get, I think it's 10 free sessions with a psychologist and that sort of thing as well. So there's quite an array of services out there, and I have some of them listed on my site and that sort of thing, but it's a matter of accessing them when you need them or working out which ones that you need and doing it. I think one of the hardest parts is actually swallowing the pride, I guess, and going and getting the help that you need. That was one thing that I didn't do and wish I had done more of.
I would imagine though that even once you have decided that you're going to leave, hearing those stats around, you know, this is the most dangerous time, you know, and this is where things can start to go from really, really bad to off the charts, I would imagine that that would also prevent a lot of women from wanting to take action, because it's sort of going, well, what, you don't know how, what's going to happen when you decide to break away. What advice do you have? Like, what can you do to try and either help yourself or help someone in that situation to mitigate that risk?
Yeah, it is terrifying. Taking that step is terrifying, and it's quite difficult being the support person as well. There's quite a few things that you can do. If you have lead-up time, it helps a lot. Many circumstances I know they've sort of had to leave on that night and there's not been much they can do about it. So if you're the person in the relationship, I would start recording everything possible. So making notes of when things happen, if there's witnesses to anything, if anything happens in public and there's like security cameras and those sorts of things, all of that will help. Report as soon as you can, report it to the police, whatever it is that's happening, report it to them so that they can document it and start doing things. But if you're reporting it to them and you're going to get an AVO and everything, you need to follow through with everything that they say, and you need to stop contact with the abuser and that. Because the other thing is, people don't realise, is it typically takes somebody 7 times before they actually finally leave the relationship. And part of it is the promises that they'll help, but the other part is the threats on your life or the life of your children and that sort of thing. So the second any of that sort of stuff starts happening, make sure you get protection with the police. Have somewhere safe to go. So if you've got a family member or a friend or something that's willing to take you in, that's really beneficial. And if you can, before you actually leave, stash some clothes there, stash some money there, those sorts of things. That will help you, because then you'll have stuff when you leave instead of just leaving with whatever's on your back. I have an entire article on my site actually about leaving and like ways to get money to leave and all that sort of thing that will help a lot. I can't think of all the tips off the top of my head at the moment, but that's I can send you the link for that. If you're the support person, providing them somewhere safe to go, having all the information, letting them use your internet instead of them using their own internet is really beneficial. Meet them somewhere or pick them up from somewhere and then wipe their phone so that their abuser can't actually track them on the GPS or whatever, like switch off, find my iPhone, all those sorts of apps. Make sure that on every single social media site that they're accessing, that it's not using the location and that sort of thing, because that's all those sorts of things have caused a lot of problems with a lot of shelters in the past few years, because it's so easy to track somebody from their phone and using the different GPS and social media and that sort of thing. It's actually become a huge, huge problem for shelters with abusers turning up, because they can track people on their phone. So the person when they're leaving generally doesn't have that sort of thing front of mind. So if you're helping them, when you pick them up away from wherever you're going to be going, and then clear their phone so that they can't be tracked. And then both you and them need to realise that this is a really long haul, that the abuse that you've been subjected to will be with you for a long time, and there are triggers that will hit you that you won't even realise, and it can be years later that something impacts you. You need a lot of support. You need to be really gentle on yourself, because it's going to take a while to not just get over, but rebuild and those sorts of things. And then if you have children, that's a whole nother ball game in terms of what their needs are and how it will impact them, and how you may still have to see your abuser for a while. But definitely get legal advice either before you leave or as soon as you leave as well, to assist with all of it. So just sort of realize that you're going to need support, and whoever's supporting you, or if you're the person that's supporting somebody leaving it, an abusive relationship, don't just get them to leave and then sort of dump them, if that makes sense. Like I've seen it happen where the person that was getting abused gets all the help to get out, and then 6 months later it's like all that support's gone because it's such an emotional roller coaster. And so then they end up back with the abuser, because what other option did they have? It was that or be homeless. And so, yeah, be aware that if you're the person helping, I highly recommend being the person helping. But if you are that person, that it's a long-term commitment. It's not get them out and then everything's hunky-dory. It's they've been abused for a long time. They've been brainwashed. They think a different way. Like I remember many conversations that I've had with my sisters where something's come up and then I just see the look on their face about something that I've said or something that happened in a relationship. And I sort of look at them like, I hear it as it's coming out of my mouth. I said, I know now how bad it is. I said, but it wasn't until this moment that I realized that that was a bad thing, because I was living it. And there'll be a lot of moments like that for whoever it's going through. So a lot of things, when you're the support person and you're outside the relationship, there are a lot of things that you will see or hear that you think are so obviously wrong. But if you're the one that's been living in that relationship, it's really hard to know where that line is and to know what's right and what's wrong, because you've been brainwashed, basically. And
do you have any examples?
The biggest or I guess most common one for myself and that I've spoken to others about, real trigger warning for people for what I'm about to say, by the way, although this whole episode probably is a trigger. So I was raised Mormon, so, you know, like no sex before marriage or anything like that, and not really any discussion about sex, and it wasn't like sex ed was that great in high school. You know, they make you put a condom on a banana and that's pretty much the extent of it. So I didn't really have any idea of the intimate part of a relationship other than what I'd sort of like read in Cleo and Cosmo and stuff. I used that as my guide. So it wasn't until I had left the relationship that I realized how bad the intimate parts of my relationship were. So because I just didn't know any better, I didn't realize that even if I said no and he still wanted it and he did that would be classed as rape because I was his wife. And so I was sort of raised in a stricter religion, and it wasn't really discussed. And many I've spoken to have said the same sort of thing, where it's you don't realize, I guess, or you're not taught in a way that it's your choice. You're sort of told to be submissive to your husband and that sort of thing. And so, you know, there was many times where I would just cry or I'd beg him to stop or hurry or whatever. And it wasn't about me, it was all about him. And it wasn't like that all the time, obviously, but there are way too many times where it was. And it wasn't until I was talking to my sister one day, and I can't remember exactly what I said to her, but it was like a massive rush just then, where I was going, holy crap, like that's the most horrific relationship intimately that you could have been in. And I didn't realize, because I didn't know any better. There's, yeah, a lot of women that I've spoken to that have said similar, where it's something like that, where, you know, they were the first boyfriend and so they didn't have any sexual experience. Or even now, if you look at the statistics and stuff from Our Watch, there's young girls who are giving oral sex before anything else because they don't know any better. Like the boys are educating them and that sort of thing. And so I think a big part of ending this sort of stuff and ensuring that we know where that line is education and being open and talking about this sort of stuff so that other people know. But yeah, that like finances, like sex and finances, are two things that are generally not discussed outside of your relationship. And so you don't know if you've been raised where it's not discussed. You don't know if that's your first experience, that's what it is. And so, yeah, that one, thankfully, my partner is amazing and has helped me deal with a lot of that, because as you can imagine, there's many triggers in a relationship if you've been through one like that. So he's pretty amazing. But, yeah, it horrifies me how many women, their first relationship started when they were like 15 or something, and then he was just super abusive and they have no idea about anything else. They leave, or there's something on the TV, or they're, you know, talking to another woman or something, and then it's sort of not something that you really want to say out loud to other people either. Like, you know, like when you have that realization, you don't exactly want to turn around and go, oh my gosh, my relationship is so bad, this is what's happened. It's sort of, people just tend to go along with whatever's happening in the conversation and die a little bit inside just themselves and don't reach out for that help because it's so confronting.
So is the control in the bedroom a common factor in domestic violence cases?
Oh, absolutely. And from my understanding and from what I've seen and from discussion with police and stuff like that, it's also the least convicted one. We dropped all sexual assault charges in my case because I just couldn't go through with testifying. It took nearly 2 years from when he pulled a knife on me, the night he pulled a knife on me, until he actually got convicted of that. And it was just too much for me. I couldn't keep going. And a lot of the time, I know of many people who've gone to report and they're like, well, you're married, so they don't technically class it as rape, which is wrong, because it's a rape is rape. It doesn't matter who does it to you, it's a rape. But many women don't realise that that's what it's classed as within a relationship, or don't speak up about that aspect of things. They tend to just focus on the other physical abuse instead of the sexual abuse, or the lawyers really, really play it down in court. So even if it does go through, getting the sexual assault convictions is extremely difficult and traumatic. Like, as the victim, you have to get up there in court and outline every detail of your relationship and everything that happened to you. And knowing that within abusive relationships and domestic violence cases and that sort of thing, statistically they don't get convicted. So you're going through a horribly traumatic experience to probably end up with zero results.
It is just appalling, and it goes to show how far women's rights and feminism and everything has to go, because, as you said, the whole definition of marriage is still so archaic that it's the woman. And even if we look at the traditional ceremonies these days, who gives this woman to this man? Yeah. And the whole, and as you said, the court system, they obviously still don't recognize that it is a choice. It's still, you know, you belong to him, and if he wants sex, then that's, you know, that's your spousal duty, and that's where it's at. And it is not true. And I have heard, you're not the first woman I've spoken to around domestic violence. And the reason that I ask is because she raised the same thing as far as saying, you know, what was happening in the bedroom. She didn't realize that that wasn't normal, that, you know, that level of control and everything that was happening, that, you know, that wasn't just kinky sex, that was abuse and that was rape. And I want women to, so thank you so much for having the courage to share and to talk about. You've come to the right program. We talk about the sex and the numbers that no one will talk about. But they are the two most important topics that no one is discussing. And that's where, as you said, in so many cases, it is about the sexual, emotional, physical control and the financial control. It's not always, or certainly not in the early stages, that blatant physical abuse, that if you're looking for whether you're the person in it or whether you're trying to recognize if you know someone in it, they're not going to be walking around with a black eye. That's not the definition of domestic violence or domestic abuse. And
we'll have too much media and focus on that side of it. So every ad that you'll see about domestic violence or domestic abuse, if generally you see the woman's fully beaten up and that sort of thing. And I'm like, most of the cases I know, it wasn't actually that that was happening in the relationship, or it wasn't that visible. It was all the other things that was controlled, like the sex, the finances and all that sort of stuff. And it wasn't until they left that the really physical, sort of obvious to everybody else stuff happened. And so it makes it really hard if all that you see or all that's portrayed to you within the media is, you know, broken bones and blood and bruises and that sort of stuff, and that's not actually happening to you. It's really hard for you to identify it as abuse if everywhere else is like, this is the picture of abuse and you don't fit it. So, you know, where do you know, how do you find that out for yourself if you're in the abusive relationship or not, if all you see is the physical abuse?
That's right. And that's why it's so important that we keep talking about it until women realise that. And as you said, it's not always just women that are subjected to it, but in the vast, vast majority of cases, it is women who are victims, not the men, but there are men who are in domestic violence situations as well. But yeah, we do just need to keep talking about it until awareness is raised, until it becomes common knowledge that this is what is not acceptable, and domestic violence is not just the picture of someone with broken bones or a black eye. So thank you for raising those points. So let's just recap. So if you want to be checking in with yourself and your relationship, because I talk to so many women where it's honestly hard to distinguish at times, especially when it's starting off with subtleties, whether it's a dysfunctional relationship or whether it has crossed over into domestic abuse. And an example that I have is around money. So I talk to a lot of women where it's, you know, the husband is, or their partner is typically controlling the finances, he's making the financial decisions. And let's face it, I mean, I work in finance and it's very much a boys' club. So it's that traditional role, the man will look after the money. Now, where the women are wanting to get more involved, a lot of arguments tend to happen. Now, sometimes it is just, you know, but the couple just needing to get better with communicating. And, you know, sometimes we sort of get off, you know, I want to learn about money because I don't think you're doing the right thing and I think you're making a mistake and that kind of thing. And that can cause friction and arguments. But then there's also cases where it's, I don't want you learning about money because I'm in charge of this. I'm in charge of you. You will not, as you said, Kylie, you will not open your own bank account. You will not do this. I will not allow that. And that is crossing a line. So to go back to my very long-winded question, what are some signs? Can we break it down into what are some things that you can check in with yourself? Is this happening? Is this happening? To sort of start going, okay, well, this is now gone from dysfunctional into leading into domestic abuse.
I think for starters, one big thing is if he won't show you the budget at all, but if you have no idea how much your partner's earning and they don't tell you or won't let you know what the expenses are, where the money's going and all that sort of stuff, that's a huge red flag to me because it's either A, an abusive relationship, or B, they're hiding something anyways, like an addiction, like a gambling addiction or something like that. So, you know, everybody in a relationship should know, I think, what money's coming in, what money's coming out, and what's happening with the money. I think that's hugely important. Next, if you're not allowed to have your own money at all, not even have your own separate bank account and put in like, you know, $50 a week or whatever for you to do whatever you want with, that's a huge red flag to me as well. If everything has to be joint or they're allowed to have their own account but you can't, that's not on. That's total control and abuse. If they have really severe negative reactions to you asking about money, don't immediately assume that it is abuse. It could be that they feel that you're judging them or how they're doing things and that sort of stuff. So it may just be a communication thing and you need to talk that through or find a better way to for both of you to discuss what your needs are within the relationship and that sort of thing. If they're not willing to listen, not willing to show you anything, not willing to let you have access to any of the money, or doing things like if you go to do the groceries, they make you pay on a particular card so that they can check the account and they can see how much it is and they expect to see the receipt and all that sort of stuff. That's a lot of control. There is no real trust there. Those sorts of things to me all indicate abuse. But the biggest things are, yeah, if you can't see what's happening with the money, that needs to be addressed. Those are probably the main ones.
Excellent points. And just to sort of finish off, you made the decision, you decided to leave. What was it finally that got through to you that made you realise that it was time to take action, that, you know, enough was enough? What was the tipping point for you?
So there was something that happened that I've agreed to never discuss that basically just triggered it for me. It was something that happened at a friend's funeral and essentially I just got my whole world crashed down in front of me and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. And it's funnily enough that it took 2 months from when that happened till I actually made the decision that I can't do this. And I said to him that we need to separate and that sort of thing. But it wasn't actually until he pulled a knife on me that we ended up in separate homes. So we lived together under one roof for like 6 months. But during that time, we barely saw each other. But yeah, it was once he got like pinned me up against the wall and there was a knife involved and stuff like that, that I just, no, the police came, took him away and took him to his mum's house. But even at that point, he still thought that we could get back together. And so, yeah, it was a couple of points, I guess, over a period of months that sort of made me go, I really need to push this through. It took that long to sort of make it all happen.
Yeah. And you mentioned before, I think, as well, that even with going through court, because it takes, it's a year and a day before you're allowed to actually be divorced?
Yeah.
Now, you guys went through the court system and I think it was you that said that he was allowed to represent himself and then question the victim on the stand.
Yes, it depends on what part you're in there for court and that sort of thing. So like actually getting the divorce is separate to the AVO and the AVO is generally separate to the actual charges, like assault charges and that sort of thing. So we were in court for a bunch of different stuff and then child custody and all of that's different again. So he didn't actually even turn up for the divorce proceedings, which I was really, really grateful for because I didn't want him there anyways. So that was all done without him. He signed the paperwork at a friend's house and that was done without him. For the AVO, the first hearing wasn't actually, he was there without a lawyer and that sort of stuff and we didn't actually have to talk or be on the stand or anything about that. That was just the judge was directly to us. But yeah, later when you're doing other proceedings or when it was actually went to the next stage of the AVL and that sort of thing, yeah, they're allowed to be there and cross-examine you and that sort of thing. And thankfully they recommended that he get a lawyer, so there was a lawyer there because he clearly didn't understand the proceedings or what was going on. But legally, yeah, they're allowed to represent themselves and basically just berate the victim there in the courtroom. And I think that that's still, the fact that that's still allowed is just appalling, because in no other circumstances do they allow that to happen. Like it seems to be in cases in court when it's domestic that general common sense goes out the window, and even things like the convictions and stuff are lower in the cases of domestic abuse in comparison to anything else. Like what my ex did to me, if he did that to a stranger on the street, for one, he wouldn't have been able to talk to the person in the courtroom or cross-examine or anything like that, but two, he would have been convicted a lot heavier and straight to jail, whereas because it was his wife, it was a $500 fine. That's how severe it is. The abusers still have way too much power within the courtroom, in my opinion. So I think if you are going to court, I would recommend that you make sure you have a domestic violence officer available to you, make sure that they schedule it on the right day, because again, they didn't schedule my hearing on the right day. So I had to sit out there in the room with him for the AVO hearing and that sort of stuff, instead of being in the victim's courtroom. So make sure you're checking all those sorts of things and ask questions the whole way along. And yeah, you can actually request in the part where it's the actual assault charges and that sort of thing, if all that sort of stuff comes up, you can request to be in a separate room and for it to be a TV screen of you talking and to be done like that, instead of you having to be in the courtroom with your abuser and stuff like that. So just ask every step of the way, basically, for protection and what can be done to protect you. You know, because they don't always offer that information straight up.
It's just, it's disgusting that that's still allowed. And as you said, that he was able just to walk away with a small fine, really. It's still such an, and it's showing again, it's the laws are archaic and we need to be pushing back to have those changed. Yeah. What would you suggest? What can we as a community do to start pushing back and start pushing for these sorts of changes to start to take place?
Well, I think on the base level, if we see something, report it, or be willing to be a witness and follow through with it. Like if you know of somebody being abused and you've seen some of them, that sort of thing, be willing to go to court with them and support them and report it and do everything that's necessary around that. Too many people I know of sort of back out of it, which was the case for me. Some of my friends just couldn't handle it or didn't want to be involved. I'm sorry, but if you've seen it, you're involved already. So that's, you're part of the problem if you're not helping with the solution. Lobbying, so like writing to ministers and getting involved when you see things like petitions or anybody trying to make any sort of change with legal proceedings and that sort of thing, supporting them. And yeah, lobbying the government for that change and yeah, sharing it. People sort of underestimate like the power of social media, for example. It's amazing how much can be done when the right amount of people are talking about it and pushing for change and lobbying and calling and sending letters and turning up at meetings or places where ministers and that sort of thing are going to be, and asking the hard questions and doing it when media are present and pushing for it, like pushing for that change, because it won't happen if we're not pushing for it. And comparing Australian statistics legally within around domestic violence compared to other countries, we're appalling. It's absolutely disgusting when you look at our stats and the really low conviction, both conviction rates and sentences here are just disgusting in comparison to elsewhere. And so we need to push for that to change.
That's right. Get involved, take an interest. Don't just think that you saying or doing something isn't going to make a difference, because if each of us actually takes an action, if we take the time to sign the petition, do whatever it is, that's where that momentum will be created and we have a better chance of pushing those changes. And don't just think because domestic violence doesn't affect you or people you know or whatever, you know, it's not something to get involved in, because these are all the little things that collectively add up to where women sit in society, our rights around employment, our rights around within the marriage and everything else. There's so much that still needs to be done. And, you know, it's appalling. I watch old episodes of satirical political programs from, you know, the 70s and the 80s, and the fact that we're still going through the same issues now around equality in the workplace and those sorts of things just shows how slow this is to change. And we need to just get more assertive, more pushy with it and just keep going. So, and please, And I was just going to say as well, in the workplace, because Kylie, you alluded to having to go to multiple hearings and they'd schedule it at the wrong time and those sorts of things. There's a lot of this is pushback on the victim, which is disgusting. But there's then all that support in the workplace that needs to be happening as well. So please be mindful of comments. I hear a lot of things in workplaces around, oh, well, so-and-so, you know, they seem to be away every other day and this and that. Please be sensitive. You don't know what is happening in that person's private life. They could be dealing with a domestic violence situation. They could be having to go back and forth to court hearings and things like that. So please just be supportive of one another. Have some empathy. And trust that if someone is not at work, there's a legit reason for it. They're not just being slack, and just back each other up. There needs to be more of that happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, one thing that a lot of people forget is that it's not just like whatever's happening at home or has happened and them trying to leave and that sort of thing. It's the court hearings, but it's also their children. And often things like counsellors or psychologists, appointments, doctor's appointments, court hearings, meetings with the lawyers, all that sort of stuff. It can end up being almost as much as a full-time job, just dealing with that, all that sort of stuff. And if you've just left, or if they've just left an abusive relationship, or they're trying to leave one, it's extremely stressful. Like, you have no brain capacity, you're not sleeping, and the amount of stuff that you have to do on top of your job is horrendous. And so, yeah, being that more sensitive to those sorts of things. But just back to what you said before too about how people say or people don't view it as much as their problem if it's not actually happening to them or like it doesn't affect them, and how we mentioned like women's rights and how far we have to come and that sort of thing. But on a really sort of, I guess, cynical level, because there are lots of people who just don't care too much about that side of things. The other thing is when people say that, oh, it doesn't actually impact me or whatever, the amount of Australian tax dollars that go to having to deal with domestic violence through the healthcare system, the legal system, all that sort of stuff is astronomical. And so if people want to be really narky, because I've seen it happen where people are like, oh no, you know, we have gender equality now, like that's just a myth and all that sort of stuff. And it's just like, well, if you want to get technical then and move past that, you're actually paying for it out of your wage. Every single week you're paying for domestic violence by being silent and not pushing for change and not pushing for more severe consequences and that sort of stuff. It's actually coming out of your pocket physically as well. And when I've pointed that out to some people who were quite arrogant about things, the look on their face was just, they could not believe it. And it was just like, this impacts everybody. Doesn't matter whether you're physically abused, it impacts everybody.
Absolutely. And thank you for raising that point. Kylie, did you have anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap it up?
Two things. I think if you're assisting someone leaving domestic violence, realize that they generally have pretty much no self-esteem at the time, and so they'll need a lot of help in building that. And the second one is, if you're the person that's leaving, be really gentle on yourself. Take time for yourself. It's okay to break down. It's okay to cry and that sort of thing, but try to keep a focus on the future and really focus on building your self-esteem, because as your self-esteem grows and your confidence grows, it's amazing how much you'll be able to face and how much better you'll do in terms of dealing with the aftermath of the abuse and even in court and things like that. Yeah, so really I think everybody needs to focus on the self-worth side of things as well, both after they've left and ongoing, if that makes sense. I think that's something that I missed.
Yep. And it was such a major point that you made, you know, don't just assume that because you help them leave that that's now, you know, it's done and dusted and they're fine, that it is an ongoing thing and they will need support. And recognize for yourself, if you're the person in it, that you will need support, and it's okay to ask for support and to get it. You're worthy of it. You know, you matter. Well, thank you so much, Kylie. Thank you for talking so openly about such an important topic and for helping shed more light on this. I look forward to having you back on the program. We can talk some more.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.